From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, The Lost Art of Enochian Magic with Dr. John DeSalvo. And by the way, welcome WTOT AM 980, Mariana, Florida, to Coast family, now 542 strong. Here's what's happening. Well, if you have arachnophobia, you don't want to listen to this story. After discovering spider webs in the vents, the Japanese automaker Mazda is recalling more than 50,000 Mazda 6 cars from the 2009-2010 model years here in the United States and an additional 15,000 vehicles in Canada, Mexico, and Puerto Rico. The company said that a spider could weave a web in a vent connected to the fuel tank system, clog up the tank's ventilation, pressure on the fuel tank could lead to a crack causing fuel leakage, and the risk of a fire. They have no idea how many spiders might be in these cars that they made. Unbelievable. Choosing to carry your luggage onto a plane instead of checking it with an airline might save you a few dollars at the ticket counter, but it's costing taxpayers about $250 million a year, according to Homeland Security. Luggage fees that have prompted more passengers to hold onto their bags means more items for the TSA workers to inspect at security checkpoints at a cost of nearly $260 million a year. Well, the next time you're on a Continental, United Airlines, American, and maybe U.S. Airways plane, you may not get pretzels anymore or peanuts. That's right, at least for Continental. In their merger with United Airlines, they've decided that their policy is no more free snacks on domestic passenger flights. This move will save the airline an estimated $2.5 million a year. Both airlines will continue to offer complimentary beverage service. Isn't that nice of them? The magnetic pole shift that is going on now has sped up and caused havoc with our weather, including a possible superstorm. When the poles shift, they change the Earth's magnetic field, and it becomes unstable. The magnetic field shields us from cancer-causing radiation. And as this field weakens, the number of cancer cases may rise as DNA mutations become more common. Pole shifts are regular occurrences and are happening to every planet in our solar system right now. Magnetic north, the point at the top of the Earth that determines compass readings, is shifting its position at a rate of about 40 miles a year. Why is this happening? The Earth's core of hot liquid iron is constantly moving. That motion, combined with the Earth's rotation, dictate the position of the magnetic north. And also, you know, we've been talking about the 800 earthquakes swarming all over Arkansas, and they had a big one just a few days ago. Well, the staff of the Arkansas Oil and Gas Commission has requested now an emergency meeting for Friday morning to call for the shutdown of all injection operations at two wells in Faulkner County. A six-month moratorium was established, but they are beginning to think that maybe this is causing earthquakes in the area. Mitch Batras with us, Earth Changes Media. Mitch, first of all, let me ask you about these earthquakes in Arkansas. Could these injections be causing these earthquakes?
Well, absolutely. It's called fluid displacement. Whether you're introducing fluid into the ground or in the case of tidal waves, and if, when there's an increase in ocean currents, if pressure is added, it certainly does damage to the tectonic plates. Or if fluid is retracted, such as oil, or any fluid. It could be seawater, oil, even lava. That does in fact have an essential effect on tectonic plates. So, George, like we were talking about a week ago, I think it was, we were right on, You and I talked yep. about this, and you know, it's wonderful when the news catches up with us. We've been watching this very closely, and I don't know when that source came out about the magnetic pole shift and what causes it and what it looks like, but that was dead on. That's really accurate. So once again, it's wonderful to see the mainstream, you know, really coming in line with what you and I have been talking
about. Even if it might be a week or two or 3 weeks later, at least they catch on.
Well, that's true. And what's going on in Arkansas can really be dangerous, whether it's a natural occurrence. In other words, the New Madrid Fault is waking up naturally. It is time in its cyclical event. Or if it's man-made through, in case of a fluid is being introduced, which is what I think they're talking about, that certainly could initiate it. The unknown in this is, will that cause a domino effect? In other words, once they start doing that, could that trigger a natural occurrence in the New Madrid Fault? The answer is yes to all those.
All right. What's new with Earth Changes Media?
Well, we're really concentrating on the solar events and what's going on, and you're right about the radiation. See, a lot of people are lulled to a kind of a sleepiness when they see a solar minimum, when it's a very quiet time in the solar cycle. They think, well, that's good. Well, it's really not, because that's when cosmic rays come in more than the larger charged particles, such as solar flares and coronal mass ejections. So we're at that cusp over the we're within the introduction of both. The common denominator is a lessened magnetic field. So that lessened magnetic field that surrounds the Earth and protects us is now not protecting us as much from lighter solar events such as M-class flares, and it's also letting in more cosmic rays. So all that, to me, fits in this period that we're in that I think our ancestors have been well aware of.
I think you're right, Mitch. Thank you so much. People who take ibuprofen on a regular basis have a lower risk of developing Parkinson's disease, according to some new research. The drug is commonly used to ease aches and pains, but U.S. research is finding out that it has an added benefit in studies of more than 135,000 men and women, regular users of ibuprofen, 40% less likely to develop Parkinson's. However, experts say it's too early to say whether the benefits of taking the drug outweigh the risk of side effects such as gastrointestinal bleeding, for example. Tens of thousands of users of Android-based smartphones have downloaded applications capable of taking over their phones with malicious software designed to steal data to send expensive messages. Security experts are warning. Google, the Android developer, has removed 55 such applications from its official Android marketplace after being alerted to them by amateur and professional researchers. The apps mimicked legitimate programs and carried such names as Chess, Bowling Time, and Super Guitar Solo, but allowed the developers to exploit a security flaw in most versions of Android. Facebook's red-hot valuation may have just gotten even hotter. According to some media reports, now private equity firm General Atlantic has agreed to buy a new stake in Facebook, the social networking leader. It's not clear how large a stake General Atlantic is buying, but the new deal values Facebook, get this, at $65 billion. British officials releasing about 8,500 pages of previously classified reports that document sightings of unidentified flying objects by the military and members of the public dating back to the 1950s. But what is not there, missing reports of the Rendlesham Forest incident that happened in the late 1980s. Linda Moulton Howe, our investigative reporter, has covered this story inside and out. This is an interesting story, Linda. Where are the files?
Well, you know, this was, to me, quite fascinating to see the headlines today that the National Archives in England released 35 files from the British Ministry of Defense containing 8,500 pages of what they called related documents, drawings, letters, and parliamentary questions covering the years 2000 to 2005, But the BBC News assigned staff to go through these newly released files and reported today, quote, intelligence papers on the Rendlesham incident have gone missing. Officials found a huge gap where defense intelligence files should have been, close quote. The missing files were about the December 26th to 28th, 1980, aerial lights, beams, and craft of unknown origin at the joint UK and American RAF Woodbridge Bentwaters Air Base. And as you and the Coast and Earth Files audiences know, I have been working very closely with former U.S. Air Force Airman First Class John Burroughs, who had close encounters on both of those nights with unidentified lights and was rumored by those outside of him to have either jumped up on a craft of unknown origin or was taken up in a beam of light. And I have also interviewed many who were working at the airbase when all of this phenomena persisted for 72 hours. Deputy Base Commander Charles Halt told me in August of 2009 that he contacted a person he knew in the National Security Agency in Fort Meade, Maryland, to ask what information the NSA had about the Bentwaters events. The NSA employee told Colonel Halt the NSA had, quote, a thick file about Bentwaters, close quote, but Colonel Halt did not have a need to know. The colonel told me it was his personal opinion that the National Security Agency took over the Bentwaters investigation soon after the December 26th to 28th, 1980 events. So what the news about missing Bentwaters files reported today means to me is that someone in the U.S. and U.K. who actually knows what is in those Bentwaters files is perhaps running scared, and having them disappear, quote unquote, is the cleanest way to keep the media and public away from the facts that have been suppressed by both the UK and US governments for the past 30 years. And George, London-based Nick Pope, who once managed the UFO desk in the MOD, emailed me today, quote, whatever the truth of this is, it's an extremely unfortunate situation. It has been MOD policy since 1967 that all UFO files should be permanently retained in view of their historical importance and the related public interest, close quote. And then from my point of view, I do not believe the RAF Bentwaters files are really missing but have been relocated to another archive, perhaps Suitland, Maryland, where the NSA and CIA's most sensitive files are supposed to be archived.
I agree, Linda. Stay on this story for us. Linda Moltenhauer, her website, earthfiles.com. Your personality, why is it the way it is? Up next, we'll be talking about Quark with Hannah Holmes on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest this hour, Hannah Holmes. She is an author, science writer as well. She's written extensively for Discovery Channel Online, National Geographic, New York Times Magazine, dozens of publications, a number of books, including Quark, as we talk about brain science, making sense of your peculiar personality. Here's Hannah Holmes. Hannah, how are you?
Just fine. Great to be here.
You know, have you seen the video on YouTube of that little baby laughing when his father rips up a rejection letter that he got for a job? And he rips it up, and this little kid is laughing like crazy, hysterically. I predict that personality of that little baby, he's going to grow up to be a happy person. I really do.
We are who we are born as. That is a fact. You know, if you're a cheerful baby, it's not going to change that much. Personality is so powerfully genetic that it's more or less etched in your genes. You can't really erase it or alter it. So, you know, happy watching your dad rip up a, you know, unemployment notice at 8 months, you might be happy as a homeless person when you're 45.
Maybe so. What is personality?
Simply put, it's the difference between how you react to something and I react to the same thing. So, for instance, if somebody says to both of us, you can have dessert before dinner if you want to, one of us might say, awesome. And the other might say, really, that's not wise. I should get my vitamins and nutrients first. That's fundamentally personality, is how we look at opportunities and difficulties. And those things are genetically determined.
So can you alter somebody's personality by socioeconomics, by environment, by behavior? Can you change it? Or are they stuck with it?
We are pretty much stuck with what we're given by our parents. About 50% of your personality is genetic, more or less. And you can't change your genes any more than you can change, you know, your genes for eye color.
And when you say genetic, let's say your mother is happy, your father's grumpy. Will you get pieces of both of them?
You will. And this is one of the reasons that we don't go looking for a high degree of similarity in siblings. I mean, if you have siblings, you know, take a look at those people. Are they anything like you in temperament? Likely not. There's very little similarity in how siblings answer test questions that are designed to determine what your personality is. There simply is very little similarity. The reason is that our brains are so complex that there are probably thousands of independent genes that influence your personality. So the odds of each time you combine a mother's and father's DNA, the same genes coming up to express who you're going to be are extremely slim. To the point that really there's no statistical probability for siblings to be similar unless they're identical twins.
What causes depression with people who generally might have a very outgoing personality?
Our personality factors, the five factors that make up human personality, are like dials that we all have, all five dials. So the neuroticism dial, for instance, determines how much you keep an eye to the dangers in the world, how pessimistic you are. If you're high in neuroticism, you are society's watchdog. You are on the lookout for trouble, and you might even see it where there is none. What happens with a personality disorder like depression is your dial gets flicked a little bit and you tip off the end of the normal spectrum into a disordered personality. So it's an exaggeration of a normal personality trait.
You know, I've been watching the episodes of Charlie Sheen lately, and I'm sure you have too. And, you know, he's at a point in his life where he's fed up with everybody doing what they're doing, and he's striking back. But in your opinion, has he gone over the edge?
This gets to the really interesting area of what we call a disorder. It's a bit of a semantic issue. If you look at a state like ADHD, which is, you know, common in kids, where they don't tend to focus for hours on end and they have high energy, that is not a disorder if you consider us an animal that evolved in a wild environment where everything was out to bite you and you had to work really hard to find something that you could bite.
And you have to sleep in a cave with your eye open.
Right. It was fantastic to have this attention that didn't get sort of stuck on something. It was fantastic to be the first person in the group to notice movement on the horizon. ADHD was a tremendously useful personality style, but we've changed our environment so much that some personalities now are so uncomfortable in the environment that we've created around them that we call them disordered. Now, Charlie Sheen is in this bizarre environment that we've created where we treat famous people as though they recently descended from the heavens. And if we touch them, you know, we might get some fabulousness rubbed off on ourselves.
The Midas touch, right?
Right. We treat celebrities as though they're Martians. And that is bound to unhinge you a little bit over time and convince you that you're more special than any other human. So oftentimes what we see as a disordered personality is a personality that is in an environment that is causing it to look bizarre.
Interesting. It's all fascinating. And these five factors, I want to real quickly throw them out again.
conscientiousness, agreeableness, neuroticism, openness, and extroversion. And we each have all five, but our dials for each one are set a little differently so that we all are different.
All right. Well, you stay with us, Hannah. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back and talk about personalities with your work quirk. I'm George Norrie, and if you need to email me, like so many of you do on a regular basis, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. We will be right back. Don't touch your dial. And we're talking personality, quirk, as a matter of fact, with Hannah Holmes. Next hour, Dr. John DeSalvo joins us as we talk about the lost art of Enochian magic. But we'll be back. We'll take your phone calls and continue the dialogue on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're talking with Hannah Holmes, her work, Quirk. How come some people, Hannah, are shy, other people aggressive, different varieties of people like that? What causes that?
The bottom line is that any species that you see on Earth today has gotten through the gauntlet of craziness that nature can throw at an animal. So nature is so unpredictable in how she flings out the great opportunities, you know, bumper crop, or the horrible punishments like flash floods or, you know, early frost and so on, that it takes a diversity of responses to any given thing that nature throws at you to survive. So we need some people who are really impulsive and opportunistic and can grab the short-term opportunities before they disappear. But we also need the people who are kind of nervous and kind of anxious, and so they saved everything they got the last time something good came around. They've had a miserable, quiet existence since then because they don't dare eat anything because they might need it tomorrow. Nonetheless, now they have a ton of food left when everyone else is starving, and they can see the population through this hard time. It takes a diversity of temperaments to sort of rumble along through nature.
Will personality changes because of maybe chemical changes in the body?
We see short-term personality changes and long-term personality changes. Some of the short-term ones, you could, I mean, have a double whiskey. You know, you're going to actually close off your frontal lobes. You're going to darken that down, and your behavior is going to become more childlike, more impulsive. So you can temporarily alter your personality with drugs or alcohol. You can experience the power of hormones on the personality if you stand near a female human for 4 weeks in a row. You will see some, you know, hormone-sponsored personality alterations of a temporary nature. In the long haul, we can alter personality mainly through disease, frankly. There are some tiny changes in your genetic personality along the lines of impulsivity. Older people just become steadily less impulsive. We all kind of have experienced that.
But what about energy? Energy that allows someone to be effervescent where somebody else is not.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, there are personality traits that we all covet. And extroversion just looks like one of the most fun personalities to have. I've got the opposite. I've got the, you know, the slow and steady wins the race personality. I've always wanted to be effervescent, but it is largely a genetic feature. It's a feature of extroversion, and that personality type evolved to be the sort of let's go see, let's go look, let's explore what's over this hill personality, the sort of scouts and explorers among us. And they have high energy. They're stimulated by new stuff and new experiences. And then just sort of these self-propelled happy machines that we all sort of look up to. There are certainly some risks associated with that personality. They're at a high risk for addiction, but still, it really, they make it look fun.
You know, I give a lot of speaking engagement presentations around the country. I like it. I like to meet people who listen to the program. It gives me feedback. I learn more that way, Hannah. There are a lot of other talk show hosts that simply want to stay in a studio and not meet people who listen to their program. It works for them. But I need to meet the public. I need to get out there. What is that about me that's different from the other person?
That is classic extroversion. That is your brain rewarding you for going out and taking risks by being among other humans. Throughout most of human history, we had to be anxious when we met other humans because, for one thing, we had no antibiotics. So if someone was carrying a horrible disease and we got it, you know, end of game. Thanks for playing.
It's over. Yeah.
Yeah. And or they might want your stuff. Even if when we didn't have much stuff, there was plenty of cheating and theft going on. So we have a hardwired fear of other humans. Extroverts have a brain that rewards them for overcoming that fear and looking for the rewards and opportunities of connecting with other people.
All right, let's take some phone calls. Let's go to Ryan in Phoenix to get us started. Ryan, you're on Coast to Coast.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, I had a question about multiple personality disorder or dissociative identity disorder. I was just wondering how your guest, I forget her name, I'm so sorry, but how she can explain that.
Go ahead, Hannah.
It's a very difficult disorder to understand, and frankly, scientists haven't quite figured it out. One of the things that's clear about it is that the people who have it actually learn how to imitate an entire personality. You know, you or I can pretend for a moment to be childlike or like an old person or like a scared person. Someone with multiple personality disorder has an ability to adopt an entire separate identity, complete with mannerisms. How they do it is unknown. Why they do it usually appears to be related to a really difficult trauma of the personality, of the brain, that causes them to need to find refuge in some different personality, some different form of their selves.
Next up, we go to Sean in Lanaconine, Maryland, east of the Rockies. Hey, Sean, welcome to the show.
How you doing, George and Hannah?
Great.
I just had a quick question about, and I know you've commented on this, George. It just seems out there everybody is rather irritable and grumpy lately.
Yep.
It just seems like everybody's angry and nobody really knows why.
Absolutely. This gets to, again, what I was talking about with personality disorders. Our species evolved living in little groups of about 100 or 150 people where everybody knew each other. We behaved better because people did know us, and if we got a bad reputation for being a cheater or a stealer, we paid a major price. We were banished, exiled, and a solitary human being is a very weak organism. We have pitiful little claws on our hands, and that's about the worst we've got. We need each other in order to protect and feed ourselves. So we have the hardwiring to be really cooperative with each other when we know the people we're working with. But the environment that we've created in the last few hundred years squishes us together in such huge numbers that we become anonymous. And that is, on one hand, extremely stressful. It's stressful because we can't necessarily trust the people around us, and the brain is really sensitive to that. The brain wants to be able to rely on the people around it. But secondly, it allows us to behave with anonymity if we tend toward a less agreeable personality. So now you can flip someone the bird, cut them off in traffic, shout at them out the window, and pay no social price. Your neighbors aren't going to look down their nose at you because you don't know your neighbors and they don't know you. So this hugely populated environment that we've created actually sends our personalities a bit astray.
Why are different cultures different? For example, the Japanese seem a little more reserved than people in this country.
Yes, personality is really diverse no matter where you live. There are always conscientious people and then really neurotic people and then really extroverted people in the same proportion. Because personality is genetic, it's really globally distributed. It's the same in Japan as here. But personality is something like an envelope where you're given an envelope full of your genetic potential. And if your envelope says you have a huge amount of extroversion and you drop into a culture like Japan where individuality is not encouraged, then you're not going to fill up your genetic potential in that culture. So culture acts like this brake on extremes of personality. In America, we really value extroverts and energetic, outgoing people. So if you're born an extrovert in this country, more power to you. This is a great place to be an extrovert. Japan, not so much. And so your culture will discourage you from expressing your full personality.
Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Bill.
Yes, hi. Hi, George. Hi, Dr. Holmes. I want to ask you a fascinating question that I asked physicist Dr. Brian Greene that I want to ask you, who knows the brain, the mind. It's in terms of personality, which relates to the mind, which relates to the brain. Now, it relates to string theory. That's why I asked Dr. Brian Greene. I'll explain. The brain is made up of all the molecules breaking down to all the atoms, parts of the atoms that make up the brain. Dr. Greene would say that each particle of each molecule in the brain, or indeed our whole body, but in this case the brain, breaks down even further smaller, immensely further smaller, into vibrating strings of energy, so that each particle, electron, proton, quark, etc., is a smaller vibrating string of energy. Now, in terms of near-death experiences, potentially, or existence after death, consciousness after death, or awareness after death, as I would call it, I am an atheist myself, by the way, so I don't agree with heaven or hell, but my question to you is specifically, could it be possible, speaking unscientifically, scientific terms, that if this is true, Dr. Green's theory on the cutting edge of latest physics, that the brain, in this case, breaks down to ultimately strings of energy, could those strings of energy, since energy cannot be created or destroyed, always existed in its form, all the multitude, the trillions of strings in our brain, and that once the body dies, the strings, the trillions of strings in our brains could live on in, say, another dimension, an energy dimension, or an energy universe, and that could be what near-death experiences are, which religious people wrongly associate it with heaven or hell, which I think is a myth. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't see why not. We definitely are made up of recycled stuff in every regard. You know, it was stardust, literally, that formed our planet and everything that lived on it. You know, we are borrowing these molecules that were created in supernovae billions of years ago. So every cell in your body is manufactured using those ancient elements, and it's just how we have to do it. We have to borrow them and put them into cellular form, and then when we die, they're broken down one way or another and returned to use in some other way. So if string theory proves to be true, I can't see any reason why we wouldn't use the same process to build the brain cells.
Hannah, do twins have the same personality?
Well, this is how we know that between 40 and 60% of any given personality trait is purely genetic, because identical twins, if personality was 100% genetic, would have 100% similar personalities. They don't. They have about 50% similar personalities. That tells us that your DNA underwrites about 50% of your personality. So identical twins have 50% similarity, but fraternal twins have about 0%, because, again, the personality is so complex that each time you shake up the genes and throw them together, you get another sibling that drives you nuts.
How about the difference between men and women personality-wise?
There are solid, sound, repeatable differences. One of the primary ones is no surprise. Females tend to rank higher on empathy, which is, you know, feeling for you, and also higher in neuroticism, which is the fear avoidance element of personality. And there are really good biological reasons for these differences. Females are smaller because we carry the kids around both inside ourselves and after they're born. We're really vulnerable to predators. And
you think you'd be bigger, but you're not.
Yeah, we have
huskier.
To be,
you're carrying kids, right?
Yeah, but we have to be fuel efficient. You know, we didn't always have refrigerators and supermarkets, so we had to operate on a fuel efficient basis. So it was great to be small, unless you wanted to have large sons who could beat up the other guys and triumph. But yeah, females tend to be a little more neurotic and a little more empathetic because we need more social support. So we have to be empathic and, you know, build our relationships. And we tend to be more neurotic because we have to be on the lookout for danger.
Next up, we go to Lakewood, California, and it's Al's turn. Al, go ahead.
Hi, Hannah. I do believe that we as individuals are all different. We're all made up different, as every grain of sand on the beach is, I believe, is different than every other grain of sand. But I do actually also feel that we are a product of our environment. If you take, a family of rich folks, and their children are brought up in a wealthy and privileged environment.
With a spoon in their mouth, I guess.
With a golden spoon in their mouth. I think that they're more encouraged to be more expressive and more individual. And if you take a family that's in poverty and is struggling and dealt with hardships and tragedy, I would think that those children would be more introvert and actually more controlled. I guess if we go back to the time of Adolf Hitler and his ability to brainwash millions of people into his form to create an army of millions of soldiers, I would think that at that time life was pretty hard for the Germans, and so they gathered in a group and all thought the same. And they were kind of controlled in that, and told not to be individual per se. So I'll just take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, this is where nature and nurture meet. We used to think that genes were responsible for about 50% of your personality, and that your environment was responsible for the other half, and so could sort of smush and mush your personality to suit the environment. There are a couple of points here. One is that increasingly scientists find that if you're an extroverted kid born into a shy, quiet family, you tend to look at that environment and say, ew, no thanks. I'm going to find me some rowdy kids to hang out with because it feels better for my brain. So it's as though the genes that create the personality go on and create an environment that feels good for that personality. On the other hand, culture, again, does have an effect on personality. It puts some brakes on. Just as we were talking about in Japan, it is not encouraged to be an individual. It is, you know, you are encouraged to go along and get along, and so you see less behavior that is outrageous and individualistic and expressive. So the same certainly can happen from family to family, depending on what a child is rewarded for doing. That gets into the difference between the personality and the behavior that flows forth from the personality. The personality is more or less immutable. But we can, because we have this massive prefrontal cortex, reflect on our behavior and say, oh, that didn't work so well the last time I did it. I'm going to change my behavior. Even though it feels unlike me, I'm going to behave differently because then people treat me better. So it's sort of like training a dog. The dog may not enjoy sitting down and shutting up when someone comes to the door, but it can be trained to set that side of its personality to the side for a moment.
How critical is your personality based on how you are raised?
Well, again, there's not a huge influence of family, is what science is saying now, that the greater influence on the personality of a child is actually the friends that that child chooses.
I mean, but what if the parents beat the kid every day? It's got
trauma.
Got to affect them, right?
Oh, yeah. Trauma can trigger your genetic potential to go off the rails. So post-traumatic stress disorder is a beautiful example of this. Some people are born with the genetic potential to be phenomenally anxious.
Absolutely. The name of the book.
Not,
The name of the book is Quirk. Hannah Holmes has been our guest. Her website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Hannah, thanks. We're out of time. Got to run.